Let's get into revolution and how to do it in a modern society. This is a long format essay written by one Kai Moros, who was a Finnish thinker and political activist. He can be described, and as you'll see throughout his platform here, as a socialist and also a nationalist. And revolution and how to do it in a modern society is basically his political platform and why and how he thinks a revolution will come about in this modern society. So let's get into it. Instructions to the cadres of the party. Be always clean in your appearance and well behaved. Your first task is to win the confidence of the people. Help the elderly, the sick, and everyone who needs your help. Help them without asking. Every soldier of the party must embody the party and its propaganda struggle. Serve the people. The ones who serve the people will overcome. Protect the people. The one who protects the people will overcome. The first task a cadre of the party has is to win over the hearts and minds of the people. So first and foremost, he's basically saying, you know, love your citizen. Be a decent person yourself. Show that you're coming from a place of compassion and not hate with your desire of political revolution. Be honest, hardworking, and just. The change begins with you. And this is the most important thing. The change begins with you. How can you expect to improve society when you don't improve yourself first? Be strong, but have understanding for those who are weak. Carry also their burden. To maintain your morale in the face of the problems of everyday life is the greatest heroism. Every new day does not bring a new battle with it, and every battle does not end in victory. And the consistency in keeping the passion in your cause are always hard to do for a long period of time. People often go through what is called resistance burnout. And it is because you feel like you have the weight of the world's problems on your shoulders, and it's so big, there's nothing you can do about it. See the revolutionary process in its wholeness and your part in it. In this way, you will get strength in difficult times and patience when nothing seems to happen. We will not win the final victory through great battles, but through the hard work we do between the battles. We will win through persistence, patience, and diligence. Acquaint yourself thoroughly with ideological literature in order to know who you are. Very important. Very important. You should at least be learned on what it is you're a part of, what it is you're supporting, what it is you're trying to convince other people to be a part of. Acquaint yourself thoroughly with ideological literature in order to know why you are. Stay fit. An ideological, aware soul in the body of a warrior should be your ideal. Stay above everything vulgar, spiteful, and vile. You are a revolutionary soul, flame in the darkness. And I think that's a large problem with people that are counter-system, is staying above everything vulgar, spiteful, and vile, when a lot of the propaganda coming from the counterculture is uses vulgarity, spitefulness, and is vile. So it's a little bit kind of under the motto of Louis Beam of, what good is it who wins if you're just as bad as your enemies?
I'm going to tell you that it doesn't matter who wins this struggle if the winning side is no bit better than the enemy that we all oppose. Doesn't matter who wins if we're not any better than them. If we think like them, we act like them, we talk like them, we dress like them, we look like them, if we are monkey see, monkey do, what the hell does it matter who wins?
So I think we've seen that rise in acceptance of a kind of a vulgarness, a spitefulness, and a vileness. Be humble. It is out of the humility that true pride will grow. And this goes hand in hand again with people being vulgar, spiteful, and vile more commonly. People are less humble, have more of an ego, more of an inflated view of themselves without even truly earning it. Being humble is something that is lost upon people. harden yourself against ridicule, for they don't know what they're doing. Kind of the Christian model of, Lord, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Same with the people who would support this system, even though they are wage slaves under it, even though they suffer greatly from it. It's essentially the Stockholm Syndrome. They've fallen in love with their oppressor. Their television tells them everything's good with their oppressor. Just like how they learned to love their oppressor, they can learn to love the destruction of their oppressor as well. A job well done is a matter of honor. Whatever you do, do it with great care and love. Be an example to others. Listen to the people in order to understand them. For the one who understands the people will win. Listen to the people and learn from them, so that they can in return learn from you when the time comes. Revolution is a dialectical process in which the party learns from the masses and the masses from the party. Our victory will be based on this dialectical relationship. Find out and expose the crimes committed by the system. Remember, when you speak, the party speaks. It is through you that the revolutionary awareness of the people will grow. Your every word shall be like a bullet. Find out and expose the enemies of the people and report them to the party. Remember, you are the eyes and ears of the party. You are the party. Wherever you go, the party goes. Act accordingly. Every cadre is a start of a new party chapter. You must spread the party organization where it does not yet exist and strengthen it where it already exists. Cadre, start new party chapters. The as yet politically unaware masses are the battleground on which the party must constantly advance. The objective of every party chapter is to take over the actual leadership in the local community where it is active. That is something yet to happen in America, where you have numerous people with the same ideology, a counter-system ideology, running in their respective areas on these platforms. This is something that will hopefully be coming in the future. On violence, the first reason for using force will be very concrete. The enemies of the party and of the people must be crushed. The second reason for using force is propaganda. We must spread fear among our enemies and increase our support by reclaiming the streets from organized crime and other enemies of ordinary people. The third reason for using force is provocation. We must provoke the enemy to make mistakes and alienate themselves even more from the people, thus creating a void which the party will exploit to strengthen its base among the masses. A revolution will always, by necessity, be a violent process. This is why it is imperative from the very beginning to get used to the idea of using whatever means will be necessary to crush our enemies. Because of propaganda reasons, the party must use force with special caution in the early stages of the revolutionary process. The party must win the confidence of the masses, longing for security in uncertain times. It cannot afford to be cast in the role of monster by its enemies. Now, kind of the sad reality, though, is when your enemies have such control over the flow of information, you're always going to be regarded as monsters. So that's even another hill to climb there. When you're already regarded as monsters because the enemy controls so much of the information flow, it's just another hill to climb. First, you got to convince people you're not monsters. The party must make sure that its actions are acceptable to ordinary people, at the very least on an emotional or subconscious level. It is vital that the people really do understand that the cadres of the party are fighting for them. Three forms of political violence. During the period of struggle before the revolution has triumphed, the most popular and useless form of political violence consists in direct action. Direct action is typical of elitist fractions that have alienated themselves from ordinary people. The fractions which engage in direct action do not understand the dynamics of the revolution. They do not get support from the people, which is why they tend to become isolated and embedded and to develop into irrational extremists. The philosophy of direct action grows out of the fact that the fractions subconsciously understand they will fail in the end. This is why they tend to seek compensation and romantic and useless needle pricks against what they perceive as the system. Direct action is the path of defeat. And once again, all that is Antifa to the T. Especially, this is why they tend to seek compensation and romantic and useless needle pricks against what they perceive as the system. The path of the party is the path of revolutionary violence. Revolutionary violence will be an organic part of the party's work in serving and protecting the people in the base areas. The difference between direct action and revolutionary violence lies in the element of propaganda inherent in revolutionary violence. Revolutionary violence means that the party cadres do propaganda work progressively, creating a people's army with a wide support within the people. Revolutionary violence results from the people wanting to protect the counter-society created in the base areas against the attacks of organized crime, small extremist fractions, and the liberal capitalist system. So these base areas he's speaking about were ideally local areas built up where people of whatever nationalist revolutionary party have won local positions, have gained the support of the local people, and these become your base areas. In order to survive, the party must really be the party of the masses. In order to win, the party must wage a mass war. The success of the party depends on its ability to mobilize people in a massive scale. Once again, this comes through populism. This is exactly what that is, populism. And we see a populist trend country to country these days, and only growing and only becoming more passionate and only becoming more aware of thinkers like Kai Muros and numerous others. The third form of political violence consists in state violence. Only the ruling class may use it. Before taking over the state, the party will wage war on two fronts. By using the strategy of revolutionary violence, the party will fight against state violence wielded by the ruling class and the direct action of the extremist fractions. After the revolution has triumphed, the party will have the instruments of state violence under its own control. During the phase of revolutionary dictatorship, the party shall crush all its enemies using any necessary means. The total character of the state violence wielded by the party will be justified by the fact that it acts with the consent and support of the vast majority of the people and of the entire working class, defending their right to a future. It is the moral right and obligation of the organs of the people's power to destroy all their enemies during the phase of revolutionary dictatorship. The triumph of the revolution necessitates the annihilation of those who would deprive the people of its victory. So there's no, hey, let's shake hands and get along here. It's crush your enemies. It's eradicate them. Get them out of your way. Don't even give them the chance to ferment and become something else. State violence wielded by the organs of people's power against the enemies of the people will have no restrictions at all. The strategy of the party in its revolutionary struggle will consist in rising from the level of revolutionary violence to the level of state violence wielded under conditions of revolutionary dictatorship. In order to progressively prepare itself for the role of revolutionary vanguard, which it will have to play during the phase when the old state will have crumbled and the new revolutionary state will be taking form, the party must, in practice, become a state within the state, already before the liberal capitalist system collapses. In the liberated base area, party cadres will learn administrative functions in practice. How to be radical without being too radical. It is easy to be radical. Everyone is capable of that. But it is difficult to be radical without being too radical. Only few people are capable of this. Experience shows that the party, in order to survive, has to be an integral part of everyday life of the people. In order to be a part of everyday life of the people, the party must respect the people. The difference between the party and various extremist factions lies in that the party respects the people, but the extremists despise them. And you see nationalists falling into that category as well. They get extreme. They hate all people. Everyone's a lemming. Everyone's dumb. They become very misanthropic in their thought. The extremists try to take over the daily life of the people, but at the same time have no respect for the conventional worldview and the needs of ordinary people. The extremists do not listen to ordinary people and place theory before practice and experience. The strength of the party lies in its dialectical relationship with the masses. The party line is this: no theory without practice, no practice without theory. We must be able to see what can be changed in people's daily life and conventional worldview and what cannot be changed. Once this has become clear to us, people's lives can be improved. The downfall to all extremist factions lies in their desire to radically alter the most sacred of all, the daily lives of ordinary people. To one who will understand and respect the people's needs and their daily life will win. And this is another common mistake we see with counter-system groups or people. They spend more time going on about things that working class people really don't care about, at least is not top three or four on their priorities list. So if a party, a group, or a person, or an idea wants to grow and thrive in society and win people over, it has to take that into consideration. But mainly, people become so obsessed they put horse blinders on specific topics that usually aren't really that important. Despite they be very important to the person preaching the message, not really that important to the mass of the working classes out there, to the silent majority out there. Like, there's always been a pathway to speak to these people, and there's always been a common understanding, and this is something politicians were very good at exploiting. But now we're in a stage where people are realizing, well, hey, we're just going to keep getting exploited no matter what they say. So they're willing to start listening to other ideas. We could even say that the party struggles so that in the end nothing would change. In other words, the party struggles to protect the daily lives of the ordinary people. Thus, the party is radical without being too radical. Yes, and that is it. Like he said, it's people can easily go too radical, and it's all too common. But it's hard to be radical without being too radical. Reflections on revolution. Due to the dialectical nature of revolution, the best ally of the revolutionary movement is the ruling class. The demise of the modern, post-industrial, liberal capitalist system will not be based so much on the wisdom of the party and on its ability to make correct decisions, but on the increasing tendency of the system to bring about its own destruction. When the system is strong, we remain stationary. When the system is weak, we advance. The success of the party at any given moment is a good indicator of the current state of the system. When we assess the state of the liberal capitalist system, we must not mistake its apparent strength for its true strength. In order to understand the true nature of the revolutionary process, one must get a clear picture of the factors which are at work behind the system's tendency to self-destruct. The state is always an instrument in the hands of the ruling class. As a socialist state shall obey the will of the working class, the liberal capitalist state is ruled in practice by the interests of the capitalist class. The destruction of the liberal capitalist state is based on the fact that the whole state has been harnessed to the service of a small, selfish elite. Their ruthless greed is in direct conflict with the needs of the working class. As the capitalist class strives to satisfy its needs, it also gradually tends to destroy the base of its own existence. The capitalist elite can be compared with a cancer. It feeds on the vital force of its host. The cancer is, as its strongest at the moment, it has sucked the host dry, but at the same moment, it will have destroyed the base for its own existence. It is immediately before the destruction that capitalism appears to be at its strongest. Just before its destruction, the power of the capitalist class and of its values will reach its climax in society. History is a dialectical process that progresses through violent revolutions. Every social system develops according to its own inner laws, travels its road until the end and vanishes. The elite is always blind. It is typical for the elites that they are open only to the blind, spineless opportunists, to those who completely swallow the official truths fed to them by the system. The dominant position of the elite prevents it from seeing the true nature of problems. The dominance of the elite prevents it as well from starting reforms, for they might harm this dominance. The paradox of power. In fear of losing power, one clings to it. This, in the end, is the root cause of why power is eventually lost. A system that develops according to its own inner laws is unable to repair itself. Thus it is, in the end, always the destiny of every elite to prepare the way for its own demise. A typical feature of the capitalist system is that it will turn against itself when given a chance. The destruction of the modern post-industrial capitalist system will be based on its tendency to minimize its expenses and to maximize its markets through globalization. The modern capitalist minimizes his production costs through automation by shifting production into countries with low labor costs or by bringing cheap labor in massive quantities into industrialized countries in order to crush organized labor and bring wages down. The modern capitalist maximizes the markets by maximizing the selling of his products in the industrialized West with the most buying power. In order to do this, he abolishes all restrictions on import from countries with cheaper production costs. The weakness in the calculation of the modern capitalist lies in that the buying power of the Western society is based on their high level of industrialization. This is the very basis that the modern capitalist is progressively destroying. Thus, we can see how the logic of a modern capitalist is self-destructive in nature. The state is the most important instrument of the modern capitalist. The state not only protects the modern capitalist and his money, but also creates the necessary judicial and material framework for the economic activities of the modern capitalist. The state is the most important instrument of the modern capitalist, but the modern capitalist is also dependent on the state. The state protects the modern capitalist not only from external enemies, but also from the modern capitalist himself. The state provides the necessary means to control the self-destructive tendencies of the modern capitalist, i.e. bailouts. The survival of the modern post-industrial capitalist system is based on the existence of the state. By continuously borrowing money, the state is able to distribute social benefits, which in an increasing scale from the bulk of the buying power of the population. This buying power is needed to keep the demand for the products which the modern capitalist wants to sell to the rapidly deindustrializing Western world. The modern capitalist wants to have everything. He wants the state to maintain the necessary judicial and material framework for his economic activities, but at the same time, the modern capitalist doesn't want to take any part in paying the costs. The modern capitalist drives the state into an unbearable situation. In order to keep up the demand for the products of the capitalist system, two things are necessary. The buying power of the population must be kept sufficiently high, and the essential infrastructure of the modern society must be maintained. Now, you can see things as the talk of universal basic income as another way to make sure there's some kind of buying power, even as we become deindustrialized, even as first world slowly starts slipping into second world status. If you have this UBI, you still give people buying power. And to keep this thing going, once again, the only thing is real is materials extracted from the earth. And what these elites do with it, and then how we play this game of consuming it and giving it back to them, is how they're kept around. So in order to keep them around, you need purchasing power, at least under this system. It hasn't become fully tyrannical. There's still this, be it false or not, ideal that there's freedom. But in order to keep it going, you need consumers. So what better way than to give a little welfare cheese to everyone now, or at least to everyone underneath a certain amount of income, to make sure they're always going to have that purchasing power. These tasks will force the state to borrow money in an ever-increasing scale because the modern capitalist wants to minimize his cost, which includes taxes. The skyrocketing interest rates are the quicksand where the state will sink the more it struggles to stay afloat. The more the modern capitalist downsizes, the higher are his profits. However, the more the modern capitalist downsizes, the heavier will be the burden on the state, which will have to provide for the unemployed and at the same time to maintain their ability to buy the products sold by the modern capitalists. Once again, while UBI becomes a great fix for them, it sounds so humanitarian and forward-thinking and progressive, but no. It's, you know, meet the new boss, same as the old boss, as far as that goes. The more destructively the modern capitalists act towards the society, the higher will the profits be until he will have destroyed everything. The constant increase of the state deficit tends to make the value of money more and more detached from reality. The stock market turns into a gigantic bubble which is bound to burst the moment reality catches up with it. We will experience the economy of hysteria. Imaginary money fuels the fair of illusions. The greedy slaves of the mammon sell dreams to each other and desperately try to make sense of momentarily irrational signs and premonitions. In the race between capital, production, and labor, it is the inevitable destiny of the working class of the industrialized West to be bitterly defeated and be reduced to the material level of the proletariat of the Third World, with which it has to compete over the leftovers of the modern capitalist banquet. The modern capitalist will always be unhappy with the state. The state is too slow an actor in the international market. The modern capitalist also disapproves of the constant borrowing of money by the state without realizing that he bears the blame for it himself. Finally, the modern capitalist shall want to get rid of the state. The state used to be its lackey. Now it feels like a burden to him. The modern capitalist wants total freedom for himself. Revolution in a modern post-industrial society will be based on the gross strategic mistake of the capitalist. He will destroy the basis itself for his own existence. He will destroy the state. The state will not be toppled by the masses of revolutionary workers, but by the capitalists themselves, blinded as they are by their greed. Revolution in postmodern industrial society will take place when the revolutionary counter-society of the base areas takes over the stateless void created by the self-destructive frenzy of capitalism. After the capitalists, blinded by their greed, will have abolished the state, the revolutionary working class will found it again. But this time it will be a socialist state, which will serve the needs and the interests of the working class. The crisis of capitalism will serve our cause. The highest form of revolutionary conspiracy consists in the revolutionaries working in order to strengthen the self-destructive tendencies of the capitalist system. Give enough rope to the capitalist and he is sure to hang himself. This means that we must give the capitalist the time he needs to commit suicide. For tactical reasons, we must oppose globalization, but for strategic reasons, we must welcome it. This is called giving rope to the capitalist. It would be short-sighted and foolish to even consider the possibility that the system could truly change its nature. At a minimum, when faced with certain destruction, and it certainly can be called a crime to even hope that the system could correct at least its worst faults. Constant provocation is the best way for the party to make the masses see the corrupt and oppressive nature of the system. We must not be afraid of an economic crisis. Indeed, we must welcome them. An economic crisis always reveals the true nature of the system. During an economic crisis, the activities of the capitalist are even more ruthless than in normal times. An economic crisis tends to give the capitalist an opportunity to rob the poor and increase their wealth even more than during the period when the economy grows. Economic crises have a tendency of generating revolutionary awareness. The deteriorating economic situation of the working class and its subconscious anger will eventually result in outbursts of spontaneous violence. However, the important thing is that the economic collapse will topple the ivory towers of the middle class complacency. The power of the capitalist class is based on capital. Capital pays the wages of the soldiers, the police, the journalists, and the entertainers. The one who controls capital will as well have control over the dominant set of values in a given society. We can see that the power of the capitalist class is both direct and indirect in its nature. The total collapse of the economic system and of the state in its last stage of capitalism will reveal that the seemingly eternal and permanent power capital was, after all, only an illusion. As a crashing share values of hyperinflation wreck the monetary system, the capitalist class will lose its weapon, capital. They will be left defenseless at the mercy of the revolutionary forces. When the bubble of the stock exchange markets burst, the only real force left will be the party. The value of money and shares is only an agreement based on trust. As the collapse of the economy will send waves of hysteria through the world, this trust will be lost because the capitalists were not worthy of it. Their hegemony will be over. In the end, the party will triumph because the party's capital is the people. The middle class revolution. The middle class is the most important instrument of the revolution, but also the biggest obstacle to it. The most dangerous counter-revolutionary force in society is the middle class mentality. Typical features of the middle class are conservatism, self-righteousness, admiration for the upper class, and a thwarted political conscience. The middle class is attracted and fascinated by the wealth and the social status of the upper class, just as night flies are attracted to the lamp. The antisocial radicalism and unpatriotism previously associated with the working class have contributed to making the middle class into a very servile lackey of the capitalists. Revolution, when it comes, will be made at the terms of the middle class. The middle class has been able to enjoy an unprecedented accumulation of wealth and upward social mobility during the dynamic period of capitalism. The opportunity for a radical working class revolution was lost as the middle class gradually grew stronger, and a part of the working class itself was able to merge with the middle class during the dynamic period of capitalism. The memory of upward mobility during the dynamic period of capitalism still haunts the minds of the middle class. Upward mobility always requires a conventional set of mind and total acceptance of the prevailing system of values. The middle class, which by its nature is always waiting at the threshold of the upper class, is the most counter-revolutionary force in the history of mankind. The problem with the middle class and upper working class is that their social values come from the dynamic period of capitalism, as the system itself is slipping into a vicious circle of accumulation of wealth for the few and pauperization for the many. A certain accumulation of wealth by the middle class and some upward mobility for the working class have not changed the fact that the people are still divided into those who own capital and those who do not. The values of the middle class and that part of the working class which has become more or less been assimilated into the middle class will only change under the crushing pressure of concrete material reality. The most extreme form of this kind of pressure is an economic depression that breaks the fundamentals of the society as a whole. The illusions of upward mobility of the middle class and the upper working class must be crushed before these social strata will become radicalized. The crisis of capitalism will take away everything the middle class and upper working class have ever had. When this happens, the party must be ready, as the objective material requirements for the revolution have ripened and the revolutionary consciousness awakens. The most destructive element in the thwarted political consciousness of the middle class consists in identifying with the values and goals of the upper class. The middle class confuses responsibility and sensibility with the desire to uphold the system of the capitalist class. In reality, the dominant set of values is an instrument of oppression directed against the middle class as well as the working class. The most pitiful example of how the middle class, in a most servile manner, follows the values of the upper class is how they adopted cosmopolitan liberalism as its ideology. Cosmopolitan liberalism is an integral part of the strategy of the capitalist class in its bid to globalize its power. Cosmopolitan liberalism serves only the needs of the capitalist class. Cosmopolitan liberalism is a new ideological smokescreen for class oppression. The middle class thinks that its needs coincide with the needs of the capitalist class. Therefore, the middle class lets the capitalist class rule the state, but in doing so, bitterly loses. Liberalism is a cancer gnawing at the foundation of a nation. Liberalism is the most dangerous ideological enemy of the party, and its total eradication from the face of the earth is the most important task for the party. Special ideological diligence and consciousness will be required from the party in order to distinguish and fight the two different and therefore especially dangerous forms of liberalism, right-wing liberalism and left-wing liberalism. All the problems in modern society stem from two originally opposite forces, right liberalism, left liberalism. Right liberalism and left liberalism, team red, team blue, are the thesis and antithesis. Their synthesis is deadly. Right liberalism is the ideological par excellence of the bourgeoisie. It glorifies the omnipotence of capitalism and how necessary and wise it is to surrender ourselves to the iron law of economics. Portrayed as fundamental as the forces of nature, as the bourgeoisie has been able to pin down the working class by exploiting the opportunities provided by globalization, right liberalism, the ideology of capitalism, has been busy contributing to the destruction of the material basis of life for the working class. While left liberalism has been pulling down what it considers traditional, authoritarian, and reactionary, left liberalism has also freed the individuals from their responsibilities and duty towards their community. Left liberalism is only concerned about rights, never duties. It believes that the reasons for dysfunctional behavior come from the outside, thus one cannot be expected to have any kind of self-discipline. As right liberalism, the ideology of the bourgeoisie, had first destroyed the material basis for a decent living for the working class, it is no wonder that left liberalism was able to break the moral fiber of the national community. The middle class tends to accept all the actions of the capitalist class, aiming to strengthen its own position, thinking that this will have benefited the middle class as well. The capitalist class can always rely on the middle class support when it tries to bring down national borders in order to let the tide of cheap labor and foreign sweatshop products come in and to deregularize all controls on the movements of capital and production. The middle class keeps dreaming of shoeshine boys working at its feet, even though the fact the middle class has resigned itself to the role of providing bootlicking service for the capitalist class. Yeah, keep dreaming of getting your shoes shined while you're licking clean the shoes of the capitalist class. The problem with the revolutionary consciousness of the middle class is that when the crisis of capitalism becomes more acute, it is the lower reaches of the working class which suffer the most at first. The middle class, of course, traditionally despises the lower proletariat. The problem with the revolutionary consciousness in the middle class is the fact that for a long time the middle class will be able to isolate itself from the social problems brought upon the crisis of capitalism and turn a blind eye to these problems an even longer amount of time. The illusion of upward mobility, so common to the middle class, makes the middle class see the crisis of capitalism as a special problem concerning mainly the lower proletariat. The middle class calculates that the deterioration of the position of the working class will bring economic benefits to the middle class. What the middle class fails to see that the logic of capitalism will in the end turn against it as well. Cornered by the crisis of capitalism, the middle class calculates to maintain its own standard of living by sacrificing the economic position of the working class. When the middle class and also the upper working class encounter social problems caused by the crisis of capitalism, their first reaction is an emotional one. The petty bourgeoisie keeps wailing and blaming the lower proletariat. In order to turn into a revolutionary force, the middle class must lose everything, especially its illusions. I wouldn't think it would necessarily need to lose everything, but most necessarily lose its illusions. Reality will pull down the middle class from its ivory tower of complacency. At the final stage in the crisis of capitalism, the pathological atmosphere prevailing in society will prepare the ground for the coming of the party. At the final stage in the crisis of capitalism, social problems will manifest themselves in unprecedentedly violent and chaotic behavior, as well as irrational political radicalism. At the final stage in the crisis of capitalism, the cornered middle class seems to have only two choices, either to maintain their capitalist system and so allow itself to be exploited, oppressed by the capitalist class, or to yield to the radical extremists and surrender to their irrational fanaticism that gives no consideration to the needs of the ordinary people. The solution to this dilemma is the party. The party will fight on two fronts. It will fight both against the capitalist class, which at the moment holds both political power and economical power, and against the extremist fractions. The party will win because of blindness, greed, and short-sighted extremism, and lack of analysis of its enemies. The party is basically the violent reaction of the middle class and of the upper working class that have been cornered by liberal capitalism. Their desperation is a secret of the party's victory. After the party has won the confidence of the middle class, it will launch a war of total destruction against the enemies of the people. Subconsciously, the middle class expects the party to deal with all necessary means with the dangers that threaten their way of life. While the party deals with its enemies, the middle class will look the other way. Yeah, and we've seen this happen quite often. I mean, we can look to Pinochet's reign as well, where that exactly happened. The silent approval of the middle class will give the party free hands in the struggle against its enemy. The political force which, within the framework of historical materialism, will truly understand the nature of the middle class and its psychology will ultimately prevail. And this is something even Saul Alinsky in his book Rules for Radical kind of stressed on, that the liberals were losing the middle class and this was to be a big fight for them because they desperately needed that. So he who has the middle class basically is the way to revolution. Problems of socialism. One of the great stumbling blocks of the socialist movement is the Oedipus complex prevalent in it. Every young socialist seems to be affected by it. Common tendencies within the mentality of the radical leftism are the healthy and youthful desire to shake obsolete and reactionary belief systems on the one hand, and a nihilistic frenzy to wipe out everything remotely traditional on the other. History teaches us that you can't defeat history. There is no void where one can create social structures without history or past. All efforts to do so will lead to disaster. A true socialist must always reflect on how he or she could learn from the past, so that socialism could develop naturally and organically based on the concrete historical experience of the nation. The second biggest mistake in building socialism lies in the purely theoretical approach that ignores experience and conventional logic. The biggest mistake in building socialism lies in trying to create an unorganic cosmopolitan socialism lacking roots in the concrete history of ordinary people. And this is where third position economics differs from that of purely socialist economics, or at least Marxian socialist economics. We don't want to cut from the roots and, you know, pretend to have a blank slate, but rather strengthen those roots, therefore producing the best growth. A true socialism can only be built on a national basis, guided by the historical experience of the people and of the nation. Cosmopolitan socialism and capitalism are basically the same. They will fall because they have no roots in real life and lack organic cohesion. The relationship between historical materialism and national spirit is the same as the relationship between matter and energy. They are opposite sides of the same coin. A healthy nationalism must not consist merely in idealistic daydreaming. Nationalism must be connected with the real world by using the methodology of historical materialism. The reactionary nationalism of the bourgeoisie must be replaced with a progressive socialist nationalism. In light of historical materialism, we can see how the nation and the nation-state are the climax of the intellectual and social evolution of humankind. Only when capitalism has been replaced with socialism, the nation will truly be free to express itself and develop without restraint. The ideology of the party must be materialistic in method and truly national in spirit. Traditionally, historical materialism and nationalist thinking have had a dualist thesis-antithesis relationship. Once this dualism vanishes, the new synthesis is formed. An entirely new world will come about. Why revolution now? A revolution in our time, as always, will be a consequence of the changes in a material reality of a given society. A revolution is always caused by a concrete change, which has occurred in the mode of production of a given society. This change, when reflected in the superstructure of that society, will bring about a revolutionary situation. The concrete change in the mode of production will create a modern revolution, and this is due to the breakthrough of modern information technology. With the breakthrough of the information technology, the modern capitalist is able to set in motion the vicious circle of accumulation of riches for some and impoverishment for the majority, which is a necessary precondition for the revolution. The vicious circle of accumulation of riches for some and impoverishment for the majority will eventually destroy capitalism. The introduction of this vicious circle has been delayed until our days because the level of technology has been so low that labor production and capital have been dependent on each other. At the time when labor production and capital were mutually dependent on each other, the ability of the working class to consume goods produced by the capitalist was the crucial factor in holding back the vicious circle of impoverishment. A traditional capitalist could not completely starve his slaves because they also bought his products. At the time when labor production and capital were mutually dependent on each other, the trade unions and the impact of the state and of its institutions created a certain balance and held back the vicious circle of impoverishment. The breakthrough of the information technology means that the bond between labor production and capital has been broken. Since labor production and capital are no longer dependent on each other, the breakthrough of information technology will leave the working class and the state totally to the mercy of the modern international capitalist. With the breakthrough of information technology and globalization, the vicious circle of impoverishment has finally started. The bond between labor production and capital, which characterized the dynamic phase of capitalism, has disappeared in the industrialized Western world since the information technology has made it possible to use cheap foreign labor and bring about uncontrolled transactions of capital. The triangle of labor, production, and capital characterized the industrialized Western world during the dynamic period of capitalism. This classical system of interaction tied to a shared time and space has been brought to a state of imbalance due to the alien elements introduced by the information technology. Damage has been inflicted upon the economic ecosystem of labor, production, and capital in the Western industrialized world by alien and uncontrollable elements, such as the use of cheap foreign labor and free transactions of capital. Thus, the system has begun to lose more and more of its internal energy and faces possible destruction. Another element of the modern revolution is the state of developing countries. The population explosion and urbanization in the developing world have created an inexhaustible labor reserve for the modern capitalist. This labor reserve is meant to be a docile instrument for the modern capitalist in his battle against organized labor in the industrialized countries. The modernization process in these societies of the developing world has reached a level where these societies are able to adopt industrial and capitalist modes of production. In this way, the developing world is meant to serve as a base area in the relentless battle of the modern capitalist against organized labor in the industrialized West. Before the breakthrough of information technology, the modern capitalist wasn't able to harness the resources of the developing countries to serve him in his battle against the organized labor in the industrialized countries. The breakthrough of information technology and globalization means a new flourishing of slavery in the developing countries. The invisible bond of the modern international capitalism is more devious than that of the traditional slavery. It gives its victims the untruthful promise of a better tomorrow and leaves them with the illusion that in a free market economy, they will have a real freedom of choice. For developing countries, the freedom of the market means slavery for their people. We must ask ourselves how to cut the invisible bond of modern global slavery, the existence of which no one is willing to admit. As the basic conditions of life in the developing countries are being destroyed, the impoverished, desperate masses are immigrating to the West. This facilitates the dumping of the cost of labor. Thus, a new form of slavery will finally arise in the developed countries as well. The spread of this new kind of slavery to the industrialized countries and the ever-increasing supply of unskilled labor are the main weapons of the modern capitalist in his battle against the working class. However, the upper layers of the skilled working class, and especially the middle class, will approve of this extortion as long as they themselves are safe from its effects. In the rat race between labor production and capital, the fate of working class in the industrialized countries is to regress to the standard of the living of the factory slaves in the third world in order to keep up their relative competitiveness. Otherwise, they will lose their jobs and turn into a backward subproletariat. With the development of information technology, more and more exacting tasks can be gradually automated and transferred to countries with cheap labor. This will eventually begin to threaten the position of the middle class. From the viewpoint of the revolution, this will be a crucial factor. The equation of modern international capitalism is this: when production grows but the number of working places decrease, profit grows. When profit grows and taxes paid to the state decrease, the share values go up. With share values going up, the increasing amount of imaginary money in the world alienates the modern international capitalist from reality. In order to maintain the social peace, nations, states try to maintain the standard of living of the impoverished masses with the help of the social security programs. Meanwhile, the modern international capitalist can in peace and quiet lay waste to the social fabric of the countries where he operates. Rising share values, the increase in the amount of imaginary money, and the statal social security programs create a delay, a time margin. Within this margin, the modern international capitalist can operate to the maximum until his world eventually collapses. The vicious circle of impoverishment starts when the social mobility for the middle class and for the upper working class comes to an end. The end of this upward movement of the people from one social class to another, necessary for the existence of the liberal capitalist system, means that the elite will close its ranks. The closing of the ranks of the elite will start the process of capital concentration. With the start of this process, the dynamic period of the capitalist will come to an end, and the objective conditions for revolution will mature. As production and capital keep moving uncontrollably around the world, the nation states will be able to finance their even greater deficit only by increasing taxes on the slowest form of capital, namely labor. After production and capital have escaped, the state can only tax the defenseless. With the breakthrough of information technology and globalization, the national tax burden tends more and more to fall on ordinary working people. With the breakthrough of information technology and globalization, a consequence of the tightened taxation on labor is that work becomes unprofitable. This is primary cause for mass unemployment in the Western world. With the breakthrough of information technology and globalization, economic activity is being capitalized, mechanized, and concentrated. What we are speaking of is the end of work, although in reality work has simply been made unprofitable because of the needs of the speculative capital. The more labor is taxed, the less profitable it becomes. The less profitable labor becomes, the faster capitalization, mechanization, and concentration of economy will advance. The capitalization and mechanization and concentration of economy is the root cause of the ever-increasing unemployment. In order to provide for the growing masses of urban poor, the state has to tax those who still have a job and incidentally turn their labor less and less profitable. With the breakthrough of information technology and globalization, taxes on production and capital will come to an end. This suits the modern international capitalist perfectly, who now will be able to simply gather the profit and let others pay the bill. With the breakthrough of information technology and globalization, the position of those who can only offer their labor will grow weaker. But those who own capital or means of production will become richer than ever. Eventually, this will tear society apart. Information technology employs fewer number of individuals, incidentally tend Information technology employs a fewer number of individuals who, incidentally, tend to be vocal supporters of globalism. Their values dominate society. Information technology is the rope with which the capitalist hangs himself. Information technology strengthens, in an unprecedented way, the self-destructive tendencies of capitalism. Information technology is the basis for an economics of hysteria and for the bubble of the global stock markets. The delusion of getting rich created by the information technology emphasizes the concrete nature of the modern socialist revolution. Information technology is the most valuable treasure of the modern international capitalist. It is the unfailing cornucopia of empty promises. As the modern international capitalist finally realizes that everything was only a delusion, his world will collapse. The only real form of capital is labor. This is why the fall of the value of imaginary capital constitutes the prelude of the modern revolution and its necessary condition. In the modern revolution, the working masses will seize power because they control the only real form of capital. A revolution in our time, as it always tends to do, will lead to the birth of a new ruling class. This class will be the one which will control the capital of the production from that the new society will base its existence on. With the modern socialist revolution, the working class will take its place as the leading force in society. The nation and the ethics of socialism. The nation is not an abstraction, it is real. It can be observed everywhere, in the people, in its land, in its culture, folk customs and language, in the fruits of its hard work, and in its common memories. One cannot ignore the nation simply by reasoning or make it disappear by analyzing and reducing it to the individuals that compose it. The nation simply is. A sterile intellect can never grasp the true essence of the nation. The nation must be experienced. The existence of the nation is based on the sense of the community and a longing for closeness, which both stem from the genetic basis of humankind. The very essence of the nation's solidarity, mutual respect, and the sense of responsibility that people feel towards one another. The nation is not an accident of nature, but a logical climax of a biological, social, and spiritual evolution of humankind. The nation is a community of mutual help and mutual dependence. One can measure a nation by the depth of the solidarity and the cooperation that people show towards one another. The logical goal for the social and spiritual evolution of humankind is an ever-deepening sense of community and a more complex cooperation. In a socialist system, the nature governs itself through the means of organic democracy. A socialist society is characterized by the notion of an organic liberty. A socialist society, unlike a liberal capitalist one, places responsibility and duty towards one fellow citizen before egoism and hedonism. The development of the individual personality is based on the influence which society exerts upon the individual. This is why the nation is the central element which enhances the social and spiritual growth of the individual citizen. One must understand the nation as a product of material forces in history. This is the cornerstone of the progressive nationalism and progressive socialism. The working class must always be able to see its role as the fundamental force behind the nation, and that the nature of the material forces in history which have created the nation and the working class itself. The development of society and of its citizens require that one is thoroughly conscious of how the nation has developed to its present form. This can be best understood within the framework of historical materialism. In order to exist and to develop, the nation must become conscious of itself, of its past, present, and future. A nation that has been blinded by empty national myths cannot do this. It will then be merely a blind beast of burden for the reactionaries, who would exploit it for their own ends. For practical reasons, metaphysics must always be subordinated to physics. The revolution of science and technology has in the minds of most people either toppled God as the final ethical authority, even more often turned him into a spineless liberal who nobody really listens to anymore. Ethical systems are products of material forces in history. As the revolutions of capitalism, science, and technology have destroyed the religious basis for ethics in the minds of most people, a modern socialist revolution must formulate a new system of social ethics. Loyalty towards one's fellow citizens, loyalty towards the nation, and responsibility towards the ecosphere will be a concrete, durable basis for a new socialist system of social ethics. Socialist ethics are not based on esoteric beliefs, controversial dogmas, or useless rituals out of touch with concrete reality, but on the needs of the fellow citizen, the nation, and the ecosphere. The development of the communitarian, secular, and ecological responsible system of social ethics will be a quantum leap forward in the social and spiritual evolution of humankind. Lastly, we end with working class, a national class. In the light of empirical evidence and in the analysis of historical materialism, it can be said beyond any doubt that all of the social classes in society, only the working class, is by nature truly national. As the globalization of economy advances, fueled by the breakthrough of information technology, it becomes even more painfully apparent that the movements of the riches amassed by the capitalist class respect no national boundaries. Money has no nationality. Upper classes, whether feudal or capitalist, have always been cosmopolitan by nature. Aided by education and wealth, the members of the upper class have been able to mingle with their peers regardless of their respective nationality or citizenship. As compared to the capitalist class, the middle class is totally dependent on the nation-state and the social welfare structures it provides. But true to its nature, the middle class keeps repeating like a parrot those anti-nation state platitudes which were taught to them by the capitalist class it so blindly admires. Traditionally, the most fervent proponents of national nihilism has been the pseudo-intellectuals of left deviation, the pampered offspring of the bourgeoisie. There is an old saying that upper classes everywhere are always alike. This also applies to the middle class, which constantly tries to imitate the capitalist class. But the true essence of a nation can be observed in its great masses, whether they be peasants or workers. In the end, it is exactly the one class which owns no capital nor harbors any false illusions that is entirely tied to the fortunes of the nation and the nation state. With this, I mean the working class. The bottom of the barrel have been the peasants and the workers. They were always left behind, ridiculed, scorned, and exploited. And yet it was they who throughout world history have built the nations and defended them. How could the working class be anything other than a national class? For the capitalist, the nation merely a means to an end. But for the working class, it is always an end in itself. The working class is the true embodiment of the nation.